Hi, this is Stephen Thompson from Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before we start the show, I want to remind you that we are recording a live show at the 6th and I Synagogue on Tuesday, December 9th at 7 p.m. Tickets go on sale this Wednesday, October 29th at noon Eastern. You can buy tickets at popculturetickets.org. Once again, that link is popculturetickets.org. We hope to see you there.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What happens when a really big bear, a cat, and the gang at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me make videos? Check out Wait, Wait, Don't Show Me, a new video series that lifts the curtain on the dysfunctional antics behind the scenes of the NPR News Quiz. Watch them now at npr.org under the Wait, Wait program tab. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, things get musical as we talk about the psychological battles and blistering solos of Whiplash, a film that pits a terrifying teacher against an ambitious student of jazz. Then we'll tackle pop culture carbon dating, why some things age really well and others, well, they just age. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we are lucky once again this week to have with us Audie Cornish. Audie, what do you do at NPR other than appear on Pop Culture Happy Hour?
I do whatever they tell me. Basically, yeah. There's a microphone, they say talk in front of that,
yeah.
And then the light goes off and I stop. And I basically shut down after that.
Yeah. You might know Audie from such things as being on the radio in your car.
Yeah.
You know, while you're driving home.
Or the radio, you have one of those.
The radio.
And I commend you for that.
You might know Audie from the radio. Well, one of the things that I heard Audie do recently was interview J.K. Simmons, who is in Whiplash and plays this teacher named Fletcher, who is the dictatorial teacher at a New York conservatory in a jazz class.
They named it Schmooliard.
And Miles Teller, who you might know from such things as The Spectacular Now or Divergent or some other stuff, plays Andrew, the student who is a drummer. They're all drummers.
I noticed you didn't bother doing that for J.K. Simmons, because if you did the list of things you might know him from,
right, exactly.
It's obscene.
You
like,
might,
writing
you might,
for this
yeah,
story,
exactly.
We were like, farm insurance, Oz, The Closer,
Juno,
Law and Order, SVU.
And I immediately think of him like in Guys and Dolls doing like, I got the horse
exactly.
And I was like, wow, he's been in lots of things.
He has been in all the things. And then all the Reitman films, which I totally forgot that he's sort of a featured player for Dead Spider. Man.
Yep.
So anyway,
yep.
Good on you for not trying to do that list.
No, and now you've called me out, and now everyone knows that I avoided it on purpose. At any rate, for me, I saw this film in Toronto, and I immediately classified it as kind of a Maker of Men film in the tradition of lots of drill sergeant movies and teacher movies, with the difference being maybe a little bit where they go with that. Glenn, what did you think of this movie?
I'll be honest, I wasn't looking forward to seeing this film.
What?
This genre of film, the mentor-mentee, teacher-student, is just poisonous to me because it's given to, I'm not going to say it always happens, but it's given to sentimentality, emotional manipulation, sanctimoniousness. It's given to where instead of characterization, you get this sort of deification of the character, the teacher, the student.
Wait a second. That's just like superheroes.
Hold on. No.
That is literally the origin story.
That's absolutely not correct.
What?
Absolutely not correct. This coasts on the burnished glow of the teacher who just wants to save these kids. What's going to happen to these kids? These films always ask. And I would rather see a sports movie. Well, actually, lost my head there for a second. Sorry,
settle
I said
down,
that. But they do
down.
Share a lot of the same DNA.
They absolutely do.
This is basically a sports movie.
This is basically
way.
A sports movie.
Really?
Complete with the big competition.
I called it Dude Black Swan.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
That's the other
okay,
way
well, there
though.
Is some of that. Okay, so basically, I was pleased to find out that sentimentality and sanctimony have no place in this movie.
Yeah.
And this really is about the blossoming of a young man under a tutor, but he blossoms into one of those flowers at the botanical gardens that smells like a corpse flower. Smells like blossoms into,
into a corpse flower.
A smug jerk.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And this film posits that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the normals who are boring and insipid, and genius artists who are smug jerks. Now, the reason I liked...
I don't know if it posits.
Well, see, that's the thing. The reason I liked this film is because it convinced me that that worldview, whether or not it's held by the director and the writer, is held by these two people.
That I agree
with.
That I agree with. That is the worldview of those two dudes.
And I totally bought that.
Yeah. What about you, Adi?
Well, like I said, I was totally into the kind of, do the ends justify the means, you know, how far do you go for artistic greatness kind of thing. Because I think in a lot of professional fields, there are the obsessives and the crazy people who are like way good at the job. And when you meet them, you realize like, oh, wait a second. I don't have what it takes to be as good at this job if it means being like you.
Right.
And I felt like that was a very easy thing to identify with. It's funny, you guys talking about sort of these two characters believing in this idea, and talking to J.K. Simmons, he was saying that they made the movie so quickly, they made it just in a couple weeks, that they didn't actually sit around and think about the answers to mm-hmm. those questions. Mm-hmm. It's really only been on the junket and in these Q&As and right. having people walk up to them and being like, well, what about this? What about that? Right. That they've really, among themselves, sat down and said, do I believe in this? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen, how about you, buddy?
Yeah, I had a little bit of that reaction of the movie stays out of those debates. It creates a lot of debates that it doesn't respond to. And at first I was kind of like, well, what side is this movie on? And then I realized that it is categorically a good thing that the movie does not
exactly.
come down on one side or the other. It doesn't judge these characters so much as present them unvarnished as very, very flawed characters. It's really interesting. I read two pieces about this movie. One was a rave review in Entertainment Weekly. The guy just loved this movie. The other one was by Richard Brody in The New Yorker, who just takes this movie down. And he says at one point, I printed it out here, it says, the movie's very idea of jazz is a grotesque and ludicrous caricature. And wow. He was infuriated by the film, infuriated by the way that the character romanticized Buddy Rich, the drummer, even though I found that completely plausible.
Yeah. Well, I went back and forth about this too. I thought the film feels claustrophobic, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's so about these two characters.
Yeah.
And one result of that is that there are actually many black performers in the film, and they're silent.
Right.
And that was very eerie and weird.
Yes,
and
I
chalked it up to, on the list of kind of things that have flaws, I just put that down as like flaw of this film, that, you know, if it's only going to be, it started out as short, and in a way, you feel it stretching, right?
Wow.
It still feels like a short.
Yeah, it was
and
made
one of the things
really
is, you know, there's sort of people of color completely like locked out of this
in
discussion
a about,
in a jazz movie. And that did feel very odd and off-putting.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I also think there's some possibility that you would see some of that at some music schools, that you would be surprised how much of the teaching was being done without a lot of, and I'm certainly not calling out particular music schools. I'm just saying it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of college kids who are studying jazz in school were also white kids who had white teachers.
The question is, does it feel that way purposefully, right?
Like,
did Damien Chazelle as a writer and director of this, like, is it because it's only rooted in his experience and so many white Americans, like, don't have any interactions with people of color?
Yeah.
Or was that some kind of artistic choice about the film and kind of how narrow the world is?
I think my larger issue with this film, and this is an area that I struggled with and I thought about this the entire drive home, certainly these characters' view of what creates greatness, I found very intriguing and very different from my own ideas about what create greatness. The movie is all about precision and perspiration. It's about jazz as the product of repetition in ways that, while any great craft involves a lot of boring grunt work, it takes out of the equation a real like love and passion toward human expression. It's very much jazz as hit your mark, hit your mark, hit your tempo, hit every just cha 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 cha.
And if it, you're is just a, if
it is
joyless.
It is joyless. Utterly joyless.
Yeah.
It's where the difference between what these characters think and what the movie thinks are a little harder to parse. Watching this movie, you feel like, wow, learning how to be a jazz performer is this stultifying chore.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, I also liked about it, it presents genius as a product of hard work. My issue with it is it seemed to view genius as only the product of hard work.
Well, the other side of that is Paul Reiser is in this film. I always like seeing Paul Reiser turn up in things. He's turning up in things more. He's in Married, that show on FX with Judy Greer and Nate Faxon. He was in Behind the Candelabra. He's in a Life After Beth, a zombie film with a bunch of people. He's great. He's always now playing this kind of lovable, schlubby, older guy. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's playing here. He's playing the father of Miles Teller, the kid. And through his character, it seems to be making a very powerful argument that unconditional love, because it's given freely, is worthless. That there's a marketplace of emotions, and it goes by supply and demand.
I'm not sure if it's taking that position as much as it is showing that to be something that is at work in this particular kid's life.
Exactly.
Because my whole thing with this movie, what I admired about this movie was the way it keeps in tension, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, these two ideas of, is it eventually going to be, well, you know, he had a son, and his son looked just like you, and his son was killed by a drunk driver.
Yes, yes, I was waiting for that.
So this is just his way of acting out. He lost his wife, whatever.
Right.
You're not going to get that.
Yeah.
Nope. And I kept waiting for that, or I kept waiting for the kid to really have the moment, which is sort of the other way you feel like this can go, where the kid will say, you know what, I'm going to go home with my pop and forget you. And this is, you know, you're not the kind of person I want to be. And they really don't do either of those things. They keep these guys kind of trapped in that weird dynamic through the movie and through the ending so that you don't really have them committing to whether they're going to say, hey, you know, this guy just wants what's best for students, which is kind of what I was expecting at the beginning, was that eventually it was going to come down on the side of, like, he's just trying to get the best out of them.
And also by giving him a father, a loving and supportive father who's there from beginning to the end, you don't fall into the trap of the teacher being a father figure.
Right.
It doesn't turn into a psychosexual drama, thank goodness.
Right.
This is literally just about two people who push each other to the verge of madness.
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciated it only being that.
Yeah,
I agree.
Did too.
One thing that I found interesting about this movie, you mentioned, Glenn, sports movies. And this is certainly a sports movie in many ways. Thankfully, it doesn't have a true training montage. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but it's very much preparing for what is essentially athletic competition. As Linda, you are a college basketball fan. Did you find that the specter of Bobby Knight hung over this movie like the entire time?
Yes, I did.
That a coach, you know, longtime basketball coach for Indiana, for Texas Tech, you know, who was known and very controversial for brutalizing his players who mostly came to love him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think part of what I found interesting about this movie is that I think that story, the sort of really super punishing drill instructor, teacher, coach, despite how great J.K. Simmons is in this movie, there's only so far you can go with that. You know, the movie is constantly pushing that this idea that the teacher is a jerk and the teacher is a monster. The fulcrum of the movie that makes the movie's tension really come out is that the kid is also kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
Right.
And as they, this is not some kid who is going to, you know, ultimately be like, oh, shucks, and then he'll be fine. This isn't just a situation where a kid is being brutalized by a teacher who is sort of over. And we should say, you know, Bobby Knight, when you say brutalize, it's not beatings. It's, you know, how you talk to people and how you're
berating. It's berate yourself great.
But it's right. But it's not just that. In this movie, it's also coming from the kid. Something in the kid responds to this way of being. And that's why I felt like the movie is not saying this is the right way to do things. And the interviews that I've read with Damien Chazelle, it doesn't sound like he thinks this is the right way to do things at all. It actually sounds like he doesn't. And I think because the kid is unlikable and the teacher is unlikable, it doesn't come across to me like they're trying to sell that as ultimately, he has your best interests at heart.
Yeah.
This movie, or certainly these characters, posit greatness as an alternative to happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And happiness,
I think that's right.
And happiness as an alternative to greatness.
I think that's right.
Both of these characters, I think, genuinely believe that.
I think that's right.
Got any friends, Andy?
No.
Well, why is that?
I don't know. I just never really saw the use.
Oh, who are you going to play with otherwise? Lennon and McCartney, they were school buddies, am I right?
Charlie Parker didn't know anybody until Joe Jonas threw a cymbal at his head.
So that's your idea of success, huh?
I think being the greatest musician of the 20th century is anybody's idea of success.
Dying broke and drunk and full of heroin at the age of 34 is not exactly my idea of success.
I'd rather die drunk, broke at 34 and have people at a dinner table talk about me than live to be rich and sober at 90 and nobody remember who I was.
he is pretty committed to this idea. He is not just sort of speaking it because somebody is telling it to him, and so he's internalized it from the teacher. Like, this is pretty deep in this kid's being.
I just simply don't look at it as being part of these other genres of coaching and teachers and helping kids. Like I said, Dude Black Swan. To me, this is a total, almost more like a Frankenstein movie of, like, you know, he creates a monster and the monster comes alive and wreaks havoc, and it's about being driven to madness. And I think it's interesting to talk about art and people who are driven in the world of art, not influenced by drugs, which is kind of the other way we often look at artists, like, you're drunk and you're this and you're that, and, like, that's what drives the art. You know, sometimes it's a little bit of madness. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I haven't really seen it approached in this way. I didn't walk out of it thinking teacher relationship, and I didn't walk out of it thinking about coaches, even though I put those questions to Simmons when I talked to him.
And you can hear Audie's interview with J.K. Simmons, which was on All Things Considered last week, I believe. And we will link to that on the blog, and you can hear him explain how he played some music himself, how he was a musician his own self. But this movie is sort of in limited release right now, so you can look around for it. I think it's going to probably open a little bit wider as time goes on, and eventually it'll be available on streaming and things like that. I wouldn't be surprised to see certain things about it, especially Simmons, maybe come up in some award discussions at the end of the year. So find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And, you know, tell us what you think about the entire teacher genre and this movie if you've seen it. So the other thing we were going to talk about today is, I believe this was a listener topic, Stephen?
I believe it was.
Yeah. This is going by the name Pop Culture Carbon Dating, which I think we are interpreting to mean some things age real well and other things age real badly, and some things you can look at and see exactly the era, the only era, to which they could possibly belong, and other things feel closer to timeless. I'm not sure anything is timeless. Is anything timeless, Stephen, do you think?
Yeah, I think if you make what you're making without regard to era, if you are going in and trying to make something that could be from a number of different times, and you leave out things like pop culture references and things that will instantly tag you to a certain place and time, I certainly think of certain pieces of entertainment as quote-unquote timeless, even though you'll still see things like, whether it's shot on film or HD video sometimes comes into play. If like, you can place a lot of 80s music by electric keyboards and saxophones. I mean, there are certain things that you don't even realize are tells of a certain era, but I think it's possible with certain pieces of art where they don't seem to come from any specific place or time.
What kind of phones people have.
What kind of phones?
I find for anything that's come out in the last 20 years, I find that what kind of phones people are using is a great way to tell exactly when the movie was made.
Yeah, if they have a flip phone, you know,
right.
It's for, you know, between.
Exactly, exactly. What are you thinking, Glenn? Pop culture carbon dating.
We talked about before the Smash Mouth phenomenon on Shrek. Why that film feels of its moment in such a huge way. It's because it's exactly what you said, Stephen. The pop culture references, the contemporary references, what they evoke is the laughter of recognition.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Simply that. Not anything deeper. That kind of laughter doesn't put down roots. It doesn't connect to anything except the moment itself. So when time passes, it doesn't have any kind of resonance. I was watching The Muppet Show. Now, I grew up on The Muppet Show as a kid in the 70s. They were pulling from like a year before, 2 years before. They were doing disco sketches. Mm-hmm. But
right.
I internalized The Muppet Show in the 80s when I was watching the tapes in college. And those references seemed like they all belonged to capital T, capital P, the past.
Mm-hmm.
The distinction blurs once you get back to that level. They were reacting to their time. We've talked before about how Looney Tunes, these classic cartoons, are also reacting to their time. They're throwing all kinds of pretty obscure jokes about Hollywood of that era. But I do have a couple theories on why some things last, but I'm going to let Audie speak because she hasn't spoken yet.
Oh, okay. I was going to unpack you in college watching The Muppets. I thought that seemed like there was a lot
story
to
checks
mine
out.
There.
It was a dorm.
It was a crazy time.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about this actually this weekend because I finally got around to watching Before Midnight, Linklater, and the last of that trilogy. And like Boyhood, that's a series of films that kind of take place over time. I think they're 9 years apart. And in the last last one, it's set with the backdrop being Greece. They're on vacation. And it reminded me that one of the things that makes one aspect of those films that, to me, makes them feel timeless is that you're walking around the streets of Paris. You're walking around like a field in Greece. These are sort of timeless places. Mm-hmm. And so it creates an atmosphere that lends itself to this. And then the second thing is they're talking about themes that simply don't change, you know, about relationships and about the arc of long relationships and about love. And it just seemed like it could kind of work because at the end of the day, it's not something that's so tied to references. Now, I don't know if I feel the same way about the first one, right? Which somehow does feel very like 90s, and maybe that's just a facial hair.
It's an Ethan Hawke thing.
But, I think it's his hair.
But the other ones work a little bit better for that.
And I don't know that anybody who didn't live in that era, like, I don't know that 20 years from now when people look at those films that they'll feel that way, that one feels much more dated than another.
That's
one.
That's true.
I think it's just because we know the hair of the 90s.
Well, and also the way he talked in that movie is so of the 90s.
It is so Ethan Hawke
in the 90s.
It is. But you know that. But they're not necessarily going to know that. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking about my very first ever favorite movie, which I've talked about on this show before. My very first ever favorite movie that wasn't a kid's movie, which was The Sure Thing, the Rob Reiner romantic comedy, The Sure Thing, which is a college movie about these two kids who wind up road tripping across the country together and hitchhiking. And it's very, It Happened One Night. It's very kind of somewhat openly, It Happened One Night. And so in that sense, it's such a throwback, and it does feel like it's kind of echoing old things. It doesn't feel like it. It sits right at that point in the 80s. You know, right. It was 1985. So there are definitely moments where, you know, you see like people wearing sweaters around their shoulders and in a way that we don't really do anymore. And you definitely get the sense of the moment. But for the most part, when I watch that movie, I'm sort of in it, right? And I'm thinking, I'm just watching this movie that I know. And I'm not thinking about the fact that it's 30 years old. Right. And then they walk into this party and you hear, Penny Lover.
Party scenes will always do it. Yeah. And we know how Glenn feels about that.
And then I just think, oh, that's right. 1980. Penny Lover, won't you? And I think, yeah, now it's 1985. Yeah. And it's one of those things where those details, as long as they're, particularly if you're using songs that are popular but not beloved, I think it's those songs that are like, they're of the moment, but they're not things where people are like, oh, Penny Lover, I'm so happy to hear that again.
Some people say that.
Can I raise a quick question about this, though, which is sort of about the movies of, like, the best movies of our time, which arguably, right, is TV. And so much prestige television, I feel like, in a decade or so, are we really going to look back at it and think that aged well? You know, Game of Thrones, like, certain things that I think... Sure, it seems sort of highly esteemed
now. Cool now.
Yeah, but I'm going to have to explain to my kids, like, this was called sex position, you know? And, like, and then other things like a Mad Men, I think, well, you know, as much as I hate hearing the hype about it, the fact that it's already a piece of nostalgia, maybe will make it survive, right?
Yeah, I think Game of Thrones should not have used the Smash Mouth song.
When the guy was taking a shower. Yeah.
But you make a good point about you make a good point about Mad Men, and anytime you're setting your piece of art in a hermetically sealed other place and time, you're going to have an easier time making it seem timeless. One piece that jumped out at me, in part because I've watched it several times within the last few days, is another 1985 movie, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Well, sure.
Which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Mm-hmm. And I was watching it, and I happened to be watching it with an eye toward how timeless it was, how much it feels like it could come from nine different places and times, in part because it is very much its own universe. It is Pee-wee Herman's universe in which he is an adult but a child. And what was interesting about it, watching it, in addition to how much I love it, there are two points at which that movie feels weirdly dated. One is you have Phil Hartman in the tiniest
non-role role imaginable. It is clearly like a pre-super fame Phil Hartman. It's this totally thankless role as like a reporter.
Right.
And so you're placing it as, okay, this is before Phil Hartman became incredibly famous, and that obviously the movie can do nothing about. The other is when they have the movie based on the story. It stars Morgan Fairchild and James Brolin.
Yep.
That was the president again. I've got to steal back the X-1 before the Soviets find the secret compartment containing the microfilm. The future of the free world is riding on this one.
I'm going with you.
No, Daddy, it's too dangerous. All right, let's go.
You are such a pushover.
I know you are. But what am I?
Suddenly, it is the 80s-est movie ever made.
But when time passes and people don't remember those people, those gags will still hold up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, I think nothing about that movie is like, it has aged badly.
But then will those gags become just nobody has any idea who those people are, so there aren't not even gags anymore.
They still look like movie stars.
But they just become anonymous. So in a way, that gag is lost.
Exactly.
But at the same time, it's lost as ballast that makes the movie seem old. It's just lost altogether.
Yeah, there's a Twisted Sister video that's also being
filmed. Oh, that's true.
That's kind of puts it at a certain point. Crazy Larry's hairstyle puts it in a certain position. I just recently watched two films. One, The Normal Heart, the HBO special, and Angels in America, which was made in 2003. Now, The Normal Heart is a play that was mounted first originally in 1985 by Larry Kramer that addresses the AIDS crisis. It's very unfair to compare these two plays, but I'm going to do it. That play is a screed. It's an unabashed polemic directed at the heart of the government at the time for ignoring the AIDS crisis. It is fueled by rage. Angels in America, which was originally mounted 5 years later, 1990, by Tony Kushner, that is coming from a place of sadness, of loss, of wistfulness for people not being able to connect to each other. And it's also hugely ambitious, and it involves all kinds of fantasy themes. Now, there's something about looking at both of these, because I've seen both of them on the stage and on television. The Normal Heart, because it is such a product of rage, it feels like this fierce and searing time capsule. Angels in America, because sadness is gentler and more comprehensive, I don't exactly know why, and because it involves all these fantasy themes, maybe artifice casts a sort of scrim over things to kind of put it in this separate place. Also, the language is heightened. The very concluding monologue that one of the characters has, Prior Walter, who has spent the entire two plays being told that he's a prophet and refusing that call, he says in the very closing monologue, he says, and remember, this was written 1990-91, "This disease will be the end of many of us, but not nearly all, and the dead will be commemorated and will struggle on with the living. And we are not going away. We won't die secret deaths anymore. The world only spins forward. We will be citizens. The time has come." Okay, holy crap. That line, "we will be citizens," has the power to reach through 24 years of history and just grab you by the throat. Grab me by the throat. I can't recall when I see it in the theater, when I saw it on television, because I was thinking 2003. It must have been dated by now. It feels like he is addressing us today. Because of the choice of the line, "we will be citizens," it has certain resonances now. The other thing that makes it so wonderful is that that is prophecy, what he's saying there at the end. At the very end of the play, he accepts his role as a prophet and says, "here's what's going to happen," and it turns out to have happened. So it's just hugely moving. There's a difference there that I can't quite figure out why it's so different, but that gets to what we're speaking about.
I think that one thing that speaks to is the idea that being dated is usually thought of as a negative thing, that when you are aware of the echo of eras between the era that you're in and the era when something happens, when something was made, that's a bad thing.
Right.
That's usually a bad thing. And I think one thing that you're pointing out here, if I understand what you're saying, is times when it's actually valuable to see something in a different time and understand it as something that when that echo of one era against another actually brings resonance to the piece.
Yeah.
Which is not to say it makes it better than it was then, but it makes it different and it has substance to it and it's not a negative thing that, although you're saying you feel like he's saying it right now, you're also saying that there's this sense of prophecy because time has passed since it was written. So it's sort of like finding the upside of something being quote unquote dated, sure, in mm-hmm. that you feel the passage of time since it was made.
Right. It had a power when it was written. It retains that power. I don't think it's just an accident of history that that particular line has additional resonances.
Right.
But it feels like ambition is a thing that factors in here somehow.
One other quality I want to bring up is the idea of a piece of art being the best representative of the rest of the category, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of this because we recently sort of re-listened to Biggie Smalls' Ready to Die album.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on private stock. Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match.
And I listened to it all the way through in the car, and I was like, this holds up. Like, this completely holds, everything about this holds up for me still. And I realized it was because of all the music out there at the time, if I was going to tell someone, hey, there's a definitive New York rap album from this period that will tell you everything you need to know about what was going on kind of politically or in the black community or in the hip-hop community or just for this genre, you would get it from this one piece of work. Like, that to me is what helps something age well.
Sure.
And I feel the same way about, you know, The Breakfast Club. I know that is
a dumb
thing to say, but to me at the end of the day, it's like group dynamics, right? And like kids and cliques, and it is the best version of all of those movies, of which I've seen all of them.
Oh, yeah.
It does the best job of distilling all of the themes that kind of came up over and over again in the 80s with those teen flicks. Not all of them, obviously, by the same director. And I think I kind of find that again and again, you know, even with modern television, like I was saying. I mean, is The Sopranos great because it's sort of the culmination of our mafia obsession.
Right.
You know, it kind of does all the things we want in a mafia movie.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and people continue to, you know, whatever anybody says about The Breakfast Club, it becomes common language. And so you still see people cite that as shorthand for mm-hmm. social groupings in high school and to some degree social types in popular culture as much as social types in real life.
And it's not like it hasn't been done well since.
No, of course. But it becomes kind of a shorthand that people use to communicate, you know the basic taxonomy of high school.
Right.
Whether or not it certainly doesn't cover everyone, but it becomes a rough idea of how lots of people identify themselves when they're in high school.
Absolutely. Stephen, talk to me about this. You'll be listening to Purple Rain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be thinking, this holds up. And then a certain kind of saxophone kicks in, and all of a sudden it's like, nope.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I was listening in the car to an XTC song mm-hmm. called The Mayor of Simple.
Ah, I love that song.
It's a great song.
And one of the things about the production of the 80s is that it has a very distinctive 80s feeling to it. And I think a lot of times people associate that production with it's bad, it sounds dumb, it sounds old and dated. And that's an example of a song where, you know, what makes production stuff feel dated is that it becomes so overused.
Yeah.
And therefore it's used badly.
Yeah. See auto-tune.
Song, all that kind of like synthy stuff that feels so 80s, in that song, it makes it just fly. Well, when I listened to it, I thought, this is the best way to get people to understand why this kind of production was cool, why people continued to make records this way for a long time. Because when you did it like this and it sounded like this, you wanted to listen to that song all day, which I usually do.
That is also such a structurally perfect song. But you asked, Glenn, about Prince and about Purple Rain in particular. I actually had the experience recently of hearing the song Purple Rain in my car, and it was the first on like Sirius, and it was the first time I'd heard it in years and years and years. And I was fascinated by how little it had aged.
Mm.
That, yes, you do have that saxophone is a marker.
The saxophone solo, in particular.
The saxophone solo can be a marker. But that record, I was marveling at the production on it and how little it has aged. But actually, I brought a clip of 80s production. Jessica, could you hit me?
There we go.
That is actually like 3 years old. That is Bonnie Bear.
I was just going to say, yeah, that Bonnie Bear record with the 80s production.
Trick question, listeners.
And I remember one of the first times I was listening to that record, I put it on, you know, with a friend or whatever, and we'd gone from this beautiful Bonnie Bear record, and that came on, and my friend just goes, "Is this Bruce Hornsby?" And it's obviously
Bruce Hornsby.
It is a deliberate throwback, and I believe Justin Vernon from Bon Iver said in some interview, like, we need more Bruce Hornsby in the world. Like, he had actually cited Bruce Hornsby as a reference in this.
But this is kind of what I'm saying, though, is that some of this production stuff, the way that it has aged, like, it's uncool right now, but you will notice if you look around right now, we are going through the 70s fashion revival, mm-hmm. so that you can make TV and movies and stuff like that where people are very glamorous and they're very glamorous, beautiful actors and they're dressed in like a very 70s kind of way, and that's allowed to be cool. That's kind of what American Hustle is. Mm-hmm. There was another movie that I saw in Toronto a couple years ago that was the same thing. The 70s are in their moment where they're allowed to come back and be glamorous. Nobody will believe this, but in 10 years, it's going to be the 80s.
Oof.
And in 10 years, it's going to be the 80s.
I thought we were still in the 90s moment.
I was going to say, these cycles
there's multiple ones at a time.
We may be in the umpteenth wave of 70s nostalgia. There was an article in The Onion years and years ago. U.S. Department of Retro warns we may be running out of past. and it was about how the nostalgia cycles had gotten smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah. Anyway, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog and tell us what you think about pop culture carbon dating, or just tell us what rad 80s songs we should be listening to, because I'm open. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I referred in our previous segment to my love of the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And there has suddenly been a big surge of Pee-wee Herman activity in the culture. I don't know if you, Glenn, you must know about
this. Oh, yes.
Paul Rubens recently did an interview in Rolling Stone in which he said, and he's maybe given this interview elsewhere, where he has said that a new Pee-wee Herman movie is imminent and that they are issuing a Blu-ray box set of extensively remastered Pee-wee's Playhouse, mm-hmm. that it will be out as a mammoth box set where they have gone through and, you know, they had to do like massive, massive work. They shot it on film, but they did all sorts of restoration, and I can't wait to see those pop again. I'm a little bit less convinced that the movie is going to be great, given that we also recently rewatched Big Top Pee-wee.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And that is not a good movie.
No.
Also, Paul Rubens is 62 years old. We'll see. I'm extremely excited to see new generations discovering Pee-wee Herman. My kids love Pee-wee Herman. My daughter in particular, who's 10, has been watching and rewatching and re-rewatching.
Pee-wee Herman and Ozzy Osbourne. God bless her.
She loves Pee-wee Herman and Ozzy Osbourne. And to me, that makes
her... Alpha and Omega.
That makes her the perfect child.
Fantastic. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I'm in this little scissor between writing the book and having to revise the book. So I have stepped up to the next generation of consoles and got myself a PS4, a PlayStation 4, and I've gotten two games. Assassin's Creed Black Flag, which is basically an open-world pirate game where you are. It's basically Grand Theft Schooner, where you just go around and, you know, it started off very, very similar to the other Assassin's Creeds, and I was like, but then you get your ship and you go out into the Spanish Main. I've never been a pirate guy. I never saw any of the Disney films, and I don't talk like a pirate days. Dumb, but this, I don't know, something about
you're
it.
You're going to get a lot of hate mail about that.
It's amazing.
Passing comments.
Now amazing. You're turning into a pirate guy.
I know, R. And the other one is Shadow of Mordor, which is an open world Lord of the Rings game, which I can't play because until I finish this other game, because I don't go back to games once I finish them, and I just need to kind of obsessively get through everything, and I am at 7% in the game, so it's going to take a while. But, oh, man, it's so
You've
much fun.
You've been playing for 6 months.
I have been playing for a while. Now,
but you're having fun.
I'm having a lot of fun, and I want people to tell me what games. I mean, Assassin's Creed Black Flag came out a year ago, so, I mean, tell me, inform me, educate me about what games I should be getting for the PS4 that really take the PS4 to its limits.
Wonderful.
I would love to hear.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Audie Cornish, what is making you happy this week?
Something that actually came out a few weeks ago, but I just happened to catch on streaming, which is the movie Starred Up. And this is a film with the actor Jack O'Connell. For those UK TV obsessives, he was on Skins seasons 3 and 4. And he's actually going to be in the next Angelina Jolie movie, right? So everybody's like, one to watch. But if you want to know why he's one to watch, stream Starred Up. It's basically about a young man who gets transferred to a prison where his father is already serving time. And he basically, I don't know how to explain it. Calling him troubled would be an amazing understatement. I mean, if anyone wants to watch the trailer, that alone, the energy in the trailer alone would horrify you. But it's a movie that doesn't take the easy way out in terms of a prison drama. It doesn't teach him to learn to love. And it's just one of those moments where you feel like you're watching an actor just be so good, right? And like doesn't even know how good they are yet because they're just kind of making do with like decent material. And I just had this moment where I thought, not to knock Angelina Jolie, but people are going to go see that movie and think like that's the movie to understand this actor or like not kind of get sort of the charisma and energy and sort of all the gifts that he has. And I'm sort of evangelizing for Starred Up.
And that is Starred Up, S-T-A-R-R-E-D.
Correct.
Up. Yes. I have heard about that movie. I will have to check that out. Thank you, Audie Cornish. So in terms of what is making me happy this week, the first thing that I just have to say is I tried to not break any rules. I tried to find a thing that I'm watching or reading or something. But here's the thing. Not only am I about to go on vacation, but I also, this past weekend, went to my, yes, 25th high school reunion.
My condolences.
And it was awesome.
What?
And my class was great. And my friends were great. And I had good taste in friends. I had good taste in boys. I had better taste than I gave myself credit for because my class was really fun. And they were awesome. And it was great to see everybody. And I will try to relate it. It is absolutely what is making me happy this week. But I will relate it to something vaguely pop culture related, which is it felt to me like an opportunity to say it is okay to explore feeling nostalgic about things, even if you don't really know exactly why. Like, it's okay for it to just be a connection to something that you know intensely. Because as much as I was close to some of these people, some of them are just people that I went to school with from when I was 4 years old.
Right.
And so when you see somebody when you're in your 40s who you went to school with when you were four, there is just a thing that happens in your brain. And I think sometimes people experience the same thing with movies and music and stuff like that. You don't have to have a specific reason in every case. It is okay to appreciate the desire of your own mind for familiarity and resonance and all of that stuff. And it was great. And it was really fun. And it was a good trip. And all I can tell you is that that is what was making me happy this week. And it was really fun. And I had a great time. So I'm totally breaking our rule against personal things and saying my personal thing is that I just went to my reunion and now I'm going on vacation.
Yeah.
So I am checked out. I got more senioritis than a group of 20 seniors.
I was saying before the taping that I have secondhand senioritis just being around you.
Mm. Yeah, I know.
I'm not going on vacation. And
yeah.
Yet I feel like I don't want to work.
Yeah, and when you get here tomorrow, you're going to be really disappointed. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. And you can follow Audie at NPR Audie. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our producer Lauren Migaki at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Well, I won't.
Damn, that's cold.
Cause I'll be gone. Cause I'll be gone.
Hi, this is Stephen Thompson from Pop Culture Happy Hour. I want to remind you that we are recording a live show at the 6th and I Synagogue on Tuesday, December 9th at 7 p.m.
Tickets go on sale this Wednesday, October 29th at noon Eastern. You can buy tickets at popculturetickets.org. Once again, that link is popculturetickets.org. We hope to see you there.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What happens when a really big bear, a cat, and the gang at Wait Wait Don't Tell Me make videos? Check out Wait Wait Don't Show Me, a new video series that lifts the curtain on the dysfunctional antics behind the scenes of the NPR News Quiz. Watch them now at npr.org under the Wait Wait program tab.